Welcome to the second class, second week of the five-week introductory course. And so if any of you might be new, I'll be going over 5 weeks the basic instructions for mindfulness meditation. And last week I talked about the basis of the foundation of posture and sitting posture, and also using the breath being one of the most central aspects of meditation, but it's not the only aspect. And the other what we build on today will be talking about our body, the mindfulness of the body, how our embodied experience is a really important part of Buddhist spirituality. So, can you all hear me okay? Is it working today without the speaker? And we left one of the heaters on, the quieter one. So if you have trouble hearing me, speak up at some point, and we can either turn off the heater or I'll speak up louder. So I'll start with a short story, and then we'll have our first sitting. Teaching story that I tell often at the beginning class. Some time ago, I was watching football on with some other meditation teachers on television. We were watching on television. And as all sensible people do, I think, when the commercials came on, the teacher had the remote hit the mute button so he wouldn't have to listen to that sound. And then we just kind of had this conversation, talked about things, whatever people talk about during commercials. And then at some point, the game started again. And the meditation teacher who didn't have the remote, who had the remote, didn't unmute the television. And since this was a mindfulness teacher, he'd been years and years of mindfulness training, I figured that he was mindful of the fact that we were now watching the game without any sound. And that he probably knew a little bit what he was doing, and I thought, well, this is interesting. And since I had some background in mindfulness meditation, I knew that one of the principles of mindfulness is investigation. Being interested in what's this experience like? So rather than rushing in with my opinion and my desires and preferences, you know, I said, okay, this is very interesting, this is unusual, and let's just continue with this for a while before I say something, before I nudge him. And what I discovered was how different it felt to, how different the experience was of watching football without the sound compared to how it was watching with the sound. And without the sound, I could follow the game somewhat. I mean, I knew these guys lined up and they fell down, you know, and every once in a while I could see that some guy kind of broke loose, and I was really happy that he was going down the field because, you know, it looked like he was going to make it to the goal line, and I could see that. And then I could see some guy running off from the side, kind of looked like he was going to tackle him, and lo and behold, he got tackled and didn't make it. And, you know, it was pretty obvious what was going on. But the... And then my friend hit the mute button again, and the sound came on. And then the difference was that we had the commentator, the sportscaster, talking about the game. And I found the experience of watching the football game was very different. That maybe the job descriptions of the sportscaster is to pull you in emotionally into the game by the way they talk about it. And he had a certain level of excitement. It wasn't just simply I was watching some guy running down the field and, you know, just kind of... But the excitement of the sportscaster had me almost on the edge of my seat, you know, all excited and yes, because the way he talked about it. And the experience of watching with the sound, without the sound, with the commentator, without the commentator, made the football game very different. Generally, when we watch television, we don't distinguish between the commentary and the game, for example. We don't distinguish often between the canned laughter or the mood-setting music from the actual thing that's happening on the television. Sometimes a joke is not that funny, but a little bit contagious. It seems funny because they have this canned laughter. Or the music that sets a certain mood and we get pulled into it. Just some guy driving a car down the road. But then the music makes it seem maybe ominous. You know, something's about to happen to this guy driving this car. And so, you know, the experience is different because of this overlay. And we don't distinguish the overlay from the actual thing that's happening. The same thing happens in our own life. We have our own commentator in our own brains, in our minds, that's often commenting on what's going on, or maybe not what's going on, maybe what happened, or what you think is going to happen. We spend a lot of time planning or remembering or fantasizing or repeating conversations or just maybe we are commentating about what's going on here, being judgmental, for example, of what's happening around us. And what's interesting is that we don't seem to have a mute button. It would be nice if we had one. But what's interesting also is we don't distinguish often the actual experience we're having from the commentary that we have about the experience. And part of the function of mindfulness practice is not to necessarily stop the commentary, but to make a gap between them so we see the commentary, the interpretations, the opinions, the projections, and all the stuff that we do is different from the experience itself. And in that gap, we can find a lot of freedom. When there's no gap and we're entangled with the two, it's very difficult to find our freedom because we believe that our experience is the way we think it is. We don't realize that we're experiencing our life through the filter of our beliefs and ideas and emotions and feelings and all those things. And all those things are fine. Meditation is not supposed to stop those things, but to make a kind of like a gap or kind of like a pause or kind of like a help us see the difference between them so we can learn to rest in the direct experience. So if you're sitting in meditation and you're being with your breathing, which is a central aspect of meditation, and then the commentator starts. Oh, that wasn't a very good breath. You know, I'm in a meditation center and I've been doing this for a while. And I'm supposed to have a very deep, long, slow, spiritual breath. And that was shallow and fast. And how could I be breathing that way? And I never breathe right. And, you know, I'm such a lousy meditator and I'm lousy at everything I do. And maybe I should go into therapy and get fixed at all that. But therapy is so expensive and I can't do therapy. And maybe I should, you know, take up meditation. That's a lot cheaper. And then you wake up and you realize, wait a minute. I am meditating. And then you're kind of maybe critical of your breath. You know, that's not the right breath. And then that filter of the opinion and judgment about the breath affects the way that we experience the breathing. And so it can be at times a self-fulfilling prophecy. Oh, that's a bad breath. And then breath kind of, I mean, how would the breath feel if someone said, you're a bad breath? It would kind of feel kind of bad. But the breath is very different from our opinions about it. And what we're trying to do in meditation is to stay with the direct experience, stay with the breath's own experience of itself, and learn to train ourselves to rest more in the breath than we rest in the commentator, the commentary, the thoughts and judgments, interpretations of what this means and what this is about and all that. Does that make sense? So let's do it. And as you do this, you might be a little bit sensitive to noticing when you've taken up residency in your commentary, when you're filtering your experience through the thoughts and judgments and interpretations, versus when you're actually resting with the immediate physical sense of what it feels like for the body to be breathing. What's the body's experience of breathing? So take a comfortable, alert posture. And softly close your eyes. And sometimes it can be helpful at the very beginning to notice if there's any predominant attitude or interpretation or commentary, feeling, which exists that might be coloring your experience during this meditation. And then at the beginning of a period of meditation, it's good to take a few long, deep breaths. As you exhale, let it all go the best you can. Your thoughts, your ideas. As you breathe in deeply so that you feel a connection with your body, your torso. The breath helps establish that connection. And then let your breath return to normal. And the idea is to feel the direct experience of breathing, which means to feel the way the body experiences the breathing. It's also helpful at the beginning of a sitting to let go of any obvious tension in your muscles that might be easy to let go of. Maybe each time you exhale, to let there be a softening, the muscles of your face, perhaps your shoulders. Perhaps you can soften your belly, let your stomach hang forward. Relax it. And then within your body, as part of your body, becoming aware of your body's experience of breathing. Not your ideas about the breath, not your visualization of the breath, your judgments about it, but the raw, simple way in which you happen to be breathing. You have a tendency to comment on everything you pay attention to? And in doing so, entangle yourself between the experience and the commentary. Perhaps you can put to rest a little bit the commentator in favor of just being with each breath, experiencing it in and of itself, as if each breath is precious or unique, or each breath is allowed to be as it is, revealing itself to you. Each time you exhale, let go of any thoughts or concerns that you might be caught up in, so that your mind can become simpler and perhaps calm. Being with the direct experience of breathing. Noticing if you get caught up in commentary, either about the meditation or what's happening, or about something unrelated, And it's fine for that to happen. It's what your mind does. But whenever you notice that that's happening, gently let it go and come back to the direct experience of breathing in its simplicity. Letting the commentary be in the background or not there at all. Our attention is one of the precious aspects of who we are. Do you let your attention be pulled around by your thoughts, caught and lost in them? Or can you allow your precious attention to be free from the commentator? And to be perhaps lovingly devoted, gently connected to each breath, one breath after the other. And then in the last few minutes of this sitting, stop paying attention to the breath, and now instead, let your attention go to the strongest sensation in your body. It doesn't have to be very strong, but whatever happens to be the strongest sensation in your body, let your attention go there. And see if you can have an allowing presence, allowing attention, feeling it directly as it is without being filtered through the commentary and interpretations and ideas, reactions you might have about it. If the sensation goes away, then go to the next strongest sensation in your body. If the sensation persists, hang in there with it. Get to know it better. Feel it more carefully. Investigate it. But always with an allowing attention. It's okay for it to be there. And then come back to your breathing. And just for the next two or three breaths, just rest there in the rhythm of your breathing. So in its simple description, mindfulness practice is a noticing practice. It's simply noticing what's happening in the present moment as it's occurring. In being a noticing practice, what we often encounter or discover is how difficult it is for us to be in the present moment. The mind has a very strong tendency to hijack the attention into thinking about the past, planning the future, thinking about the future, going into fantasy, or sometimes it can be in the present moment, but it's sucked up into interpretations and judgments and ideas about what's happening. In its simplicity, it's a noticing practice that allows things to be as they are. And a lot of the training of mindfulness practice is a training in learning how to have the capacity, learning how to develop that capacity to be present for things without reacting to it all the time, without always being for it, against it, pushing it away or holding on to it, but let there be kind of a sacred pause, some people might say, kind of an allowance, sacred allowance or openness or presence that at least for a while just lets things be as they are. And meditation training is very much a training to discover that capacity to leave things alone while simply noticing how they are in a very simple way. As the noticing gets more concentrated and calmer and more peaceful, we tend to notice some of the subtle ways in which we get entangled in our lives and subtle ways in which we react and respond that might not be obvious when we're not very quiet. And that allows us to let go or simplify that. And becomes kind of a path then of greater freedom and release from all the entanglements of reactivity. And so a tremendous peace and joy can arise from cultivating an all-pervasive, allowing attention to what's happening in the moment. We do that in meditation. To some degree, we can learn to do that in daily life. In daily life, we also have to know how to act and respond and react in a sense. But if you can develop, if you have the capacity to know how not to automatically react, to be an automatic pilot, then you'll probably respond more appropriately and wiser in the things that you do in the world than if you're always coming out of habitual reactivity. So the training of meditation is very helpful for living a much more stress-free life. Some people don't appreciate how simple the mindfulness practice is. And we have all these agendas and ideas, interpretations, commentary about what meditation is really supposed to be like. I'm supposed to get calm. I'm supposed to get peaceful. I'm supposed to get filled with joy and bliss. I'm supposed to get concentrated. I'm supposed to. All these supposed to. If only this wasn't happening to me right now, then I could meditate. If only, the if only attitude. It's really unnecessary. The mindfulness practice is simply noticing what is actually happening right now. So one of the things that's happened to us is our bodily experience. And learning to pay attention to our bodily experience is an important part of mindfulness practice. And in fact, it's an important part of living wisely because much of our body, much of our human life is processed through the body. And if we're disconnected to the body, then we won't actually feel much of what our life is about, nor will we be very sensitive instruments to perceive what our life is about around us, within us or around us. It's like the body is like this great antenna that can pick up so much of what's going on within us and outside of us. But if you're shut off from your body, don't pay attention to it. If you're always in your thoughts and your busyness and ideas and plans and things you have to do, and don't really pay attention to the body, then this tremendous antenna, this tremendous instrument of awareness, is not available for you to provide you with its service, its help. It's, you know, it doesn't really help us. And in fact, in Buddhism, the mind and the body are considered to be a unit that work together. And sometimes in some philosophies, they separate the mind and the body as being two different things. In Buddhism, the two are interdependent, or completely connected to each other. And so what we say is that if you don't pay attention to your body, you actually lose touch with part of your mind. You actually lose touch with a wider part of your psyche. And if you want to really open up to the fuller aspects of our whole psyche, you also need to open up to the fuller aspects of your body. So the body then becomes a very important way of developing Buddhist spirituality, because there is no freedom, spiritual freedom in Buddhism, without cultivating some degree of embodied freedom in our body also. Now the way that the body comes into play with mindfulness meditation is that we sit down and we give ourselves to the breath to develop concentration, stability, to help the breath maybe calm us a little bit. But then if there are other things in the background of attention, if in the foreground of attention you can keep the breath there, in the background of attention you're aware of sounds or body sensations or thoughts or whatever, as long as they're in the background, it's okay to just leave them there and let the stability continue to develop on the breathing. Sooner or later, something from the background will come into the foreground. And then you don't have to then... And then if it's in the foreground, if you stay with the breathing, there might be a tension between your attempt to stay with the breath and this other thing which is kind of compelling, kind of wants attention. So the mindfulness practice then is to let go of the breathing and let that meditative awareness settle on that new thing which has come into the foreground, and let the breath recede to the background. So if I'm sitting here, minding my own breath, and at some point, my knee starts hurting sitting here, and it's kind of a strong, compelling sensation in my knee. What we do then is I would let go of the breath, and I would let my attention settle on that sensation in the knee. Just let that be the place where the meditation occurs. Do a knee meditation. And try to be very sensitive whether I'm experiencing that knee through the filter of my commentary, reactions, attitudes, interpretations, or whether I'm experiencing in and of itself as it actually is. Because I know that if I experience it through my interpretation of it, I'm much more likely to feel suffering. I'm much more likely to contract around that experience. So I'm sitting here and my knee hurts, and rather than just being there with the simplicity of a knee hurting, my mind goes, oh my gosh, I'll never sit through the sitting, and this is terrible for my knee to be hurting, and I'm sure that if I sit any longer that something really awful is going to happen to me. And in fact, I don't know what kind of... Maybe it's cancer. It must be something like that in my knee. And how can I be sure? And why doesn't that guy up there ring the bell to end the sitting? Because don't they know that meditation shouldn't be more than 5 minutes? And it's been 15 minutes now. And so off the mind goes galloping away. It's been hijacked by the thoughts and interpretations. And one of them might be, I might get afraid of it there, or angry that it's there. And as these reactions take precedent, it often causes me to suffer, causes me to be anxious, and sometimes causes me muscles to contract around that pain in my knee, and actually can make it a lot worse. What we're trying to cultivate in mindfulness meditation is the ability to rest the attention there, as opposed to let the attention be caught up in the interpretations and ideas. And so it's a training to learn how to do that. So bring the attention carefully to the knee and feel the sensations there, explore them, get to know them, being sensitive to how we're relating to it so that that doesn't trip us up. Maybe getting kind of more precise. You know, what is actually the sensation of pain? Because pain is an abstract label. It can be made up of many different sensations. So part of mindfulness then is to go and find out exactly what it is. Is it tightness? Is it stabbing? Is it pulling, twisting, burning, searing? There's all kinds of sensations it might be. And just to really go in there and feel it. I hope it is not pain that pulls you away, but sometimes that's what happens. One of the interesting things about meditation, or any practice, I think, mindfulness awareness practice that helps you relax, is that if we're chronically tense, there's a way in which the muscles go numb. And then as we become more aware and relax a little bit, it tends to reveal how much pain is stored in that numbness. And so sometimes the process of relaxation involves a period of actually feeling the tense and painful shoulders, for example, rather than going back into a numb state. So part of developing a mindfulness meditation and really being able to relax deeply is learning how then to allow for that and not to make it worse by our reactions and simply bring attention to that discomfort and learn how to cultivate that non-reactive awareness, or just this, in its own right. So if there's some strong body sensation that's more compelling than the breath, the practice is let go of the breathing and let the attention go to that strong body sensation. Sometimes when you pay attention to a sensation, it goes away. How many of you found that when you paid attention to the strongest sensation in your body, it went away as you paid attention to it? Yeah. And how many found out that it got stronger as you paid attention to it? And the rest of you, I take it, it was the same. Nothing happened at all to it. Is that right? Well, those are the three options of what could happen. And in noticing practice, our job is simply notice what it happens to it as we pay attention to it, without any agenda, what's supposed to happen. So if there's a strong body sensation, and then some other body sensation becomes even more compelling, then we'll let go of the first one and take up the second one. If there's a strong sound, which is really compelling, then we just matter-of-factly let go of the breath or whatever else we're paying attention to and do listening meditation, hearing. So the sounds that you hear during meditation don't have to be seen as a distraction. They're just another way, another place to develop this allowing awareness, meditative awareness of what's happening in the present moment. Is this making sense? So do you have any questions so far of what I've talked about? Yeah. Well, if it's scorpion, you should probably maybe choose what the wise course of action might be. But if it's a fly or a flea or a mosquito, the usual way in Buddhism is just you treat it like anything else, or an itch, for example, if it's very compelling, you bring your attention there to feel it, but you don't swat it away. And what's interesting about most insects like that, or itches, is that you're not going to die. It's not so horrible. And so, but it can be very compelling, and you can be very aversive to it. And so, you get to work with all those aspects in a voluntary way, in a situation where it's easy to kind of maybe shoo it away. And but here you get to voluntarily look into a situation that's relatively safe to deal with aversion and irritation and impatience. Whereas it might be in daily life that it's not so easy to do that. So it's like a laboratory here of how learning how to not get caught by aversion and how not to be led around by your nose by the aversion. So it's a great training area. It's also probably one of the secret practices of Thailand where more meditators have developed really deep concentration than any other meditation practice is the mosquito meditation. You're sitting there and minding your own breath, and suddenly you hear this bzzz. And so you get to do listening meditation. And then all the reactions that come up, and you try just to let go of those, or just be with the simplicity of listening. And then you feel it landing on your cheek. And if you really develop your mindfulness really well, you can really feel what it's like for a mosquito to start walking around your cheek. So walking around, and you really, you know, it's very compelling. It's very, all your fantasies and all your planning about the future, it's all kind of tends to go away really easily. You know, you're just really in the present then. Wow. And you realize how easy it could be. And you feel this little walking around. And then you don't feel anything. And if you've done this enough times, you know what that means. And that means that it's poked. It's probably made you numb a little bit. And then you hear this bzzz. And it goes away. And then you know that a few moments or minutes later, you start feeling this itch. You know. And it's had its meal, and it's going off someplace else. And by the time all that's done, you're really concentrated. You're really right there. You're not anywhere else. You're not in the past. You're just really there for that. Now, most people would think that if you said that's what you're doing, they think you're kind of crazy. There was a friend of mine who taught mindfulness-based stress reduction, this practice in a kind of a clinical setting. And he would tell people when they had physical pain that what you should do is pay attention to it. Bring your attention to really focus on it. And people would get angry with him. I came here just to feel less pain, to suffer less. And you were supposed to help me how not to feel the pain. You know, give me a pill, give me anything, you know, so I don't have to feel it. And he said, no, this is really the path to feel less pain is to really study it and be present for it and learn not to be reactive to it and not to how to compound it and to understand what you need to do to take responsibility and make some adjustment through the pain, to learn the message of the pain, rather than kind of feeling, I'm not responsible, the pill's going to take care of things, and I'm just going to go about my life whatever way I want. So, but sometimes when you sit and a strong bodily sensation arises, it might be a very pleasant one. Maybe you might feel some wonderful tingling or warm pressure in your cheeks or some bubbling joy someplace. And then the meditation teacher says, well, you're supposed to pay attention to that. You say, great, that's what I want. That seems like a good practice. But you might, when the teacher says, you know, pay attention to the painful sensations, who are these people? Why is he telling me this? And we have very strong preferences. And actually, in order to become free, which is the purpose of mindfulness meditation, you have to establish your attention outside of the realm of your preferences. Outside the realm of whether you like what's happening or don't like what's happening. And that's one of the reasons why this practice can be very, very radical for people, very transformative. Because most of us can often be led around by our preferences and likes and dislikes. And discover that ability not to be led around by them. You can still have them, but to find yourself independent of them, so you're not acting on automatic pilot, is very, very freeing. Other questions? Questions? Yes?
I'm curious or confused, I guess, earlier when we were talking about pain and studying it, or is it serum, is it U.S. serum categories, how is that different from commentary? It seems to me it puts them into mental categorization.
It might in a very, very rudimentary way. There are kind of levels of cognitive activity of the mind. So if you simply recognize something as heat, even the mind might even use the word heat or something, then that's pretty innocent. And it's like keeping you in the present moment. But if you are saying, oh, this is heat, and this reminds me of the time I was on the beach in Hawaii, and, you know, and in fact it reminds me of how wonderful it was on the beach of Hawaii, and I think I'd rather be in Hawaii right now. Then, you know, it gets increasingly abstract and you know, distant as we keep making associations. And then we get lost from the present moment. So some very innocent, rudimentary cognitive behavior might be going on. But it doesn't have to be. So, for example, you might feel a warm breeze against your cheek. And you're not thinking about it, But 30 seconds later, someone says, did you feel that warm breeze? So, oh, yeah, I felt it. But you weren't engaged in it, you know, in terms of thoughts and ideas. The sensation spoke for itself, in a sense. To investigate or study is to allow the sensations to speak for themselves more by having a very keen attention on that place. And it becomes, you know, kind of obvious for the most part what it might be. So we'll do an exercise now to speak to this. And after the exercise, we'll all stand up a little bit and do standing meditation in case you're getting restless from sitting so much. You know what's coming. So you don't have to have commentary. So you ready? Okay. So just put your hand in front of you. Put your hand facing up. You can either hold it up or put it on your lap. And then close your eyes. And then become aware of the sensations in your hand. As if your hand is an organ of perception that can become more sensitive. Let the attention sensitize you to what's happening in your hand, just the sensations. On the palm of your hand, what are the variety of sensations you can feel on your palm? Tingling, pressure, pulsing, warmth, coolness. Pressure. Just in your palm itself, the sensations you're aware of, do they move around? Do they arise and pass? Do they change? Are they constant? The sensations of your fingers. The back of your hand. Is there any tightness in your hands? Any feelings of relaxation? By tuning into your hand more and more carefully, how subtle can you be aware of sensations there? How sensitive can you make the hand? And now compare it to your other hand, which is most sensitive and alive and energetic, energized? And then you put your hand down and open your eyes. So what happened to some of you as you were doing that exercise? Yes?
I found that the pain left my shoulder. You know, the hand was there, and I stayed with the hand, and then my thoughts crept up to what was holding the hand.
Uh-huh. The hand. So the sensation in your back of your was more compelling, was stronger, maybe more pronounced, and so you kept being pulled there.
And if I hadn't had your input, I probably would have gone with your suggestion. said before was to go to it and stay with it. And then your mind or your speech was bringing me back to my hand.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Was it easier to stay with the concentration of the hand as I held it up than in the exercise before, just trying to feel the body in general?
Uh-huh. Did you have any experience of your hands becoming more sensitive over time as you watched? Were you surprised by how many sensations you could be aware of in your hands?
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you manufacture those sensations? Or do you think some of those were always happening there? You were just tuning in more? Sorry? Always happening. Yeah, for the most part, unless you were kind of straining with holding your hand this way, there's a tremendous sensation, a range of sensations happening all the time in the body. And mostly we're unaware of it because we don't pay attention to it. We're paying attention to something else, usually our thoughts and ideas and what's happening around us. But it's possible to develop our sensitivity to the body, our mindfulness of the body, so the body, the whole body, whole embodied experience is much more vital and alive and present and sensitive. And it's wonderful, it's wonderfully healing and holistic, healthy, to be able to come to life in the aliveness of our body, rather than, in a sense, the two-dimensional world of just our thoughts and ideas. It's kind of like if you go running, for example, do some exercise, sometimes afterwards you feel really alive because of all the blood and everything is flowing. With attention, you can get the same effect, but just awakening the attention from the inside. So there's a lot to discover in our body. So now, let's stand. And then have your feet kind of hips distance from each other. And close your eyes. And let your knees be a little bit relaxed slightly so they're not locked. And feel the weight of your body against the floor. And if need be, adjust yourself a little bit so the weight is even throughout the feet, not leaning forward or backwards, to the side. And then bring your attention to the area of your head in the same way in which we became sensitive to the hand by focusing on one hand. Allow your whole area of your head, your face, your scalp, your neck, temple area, just kind of let it become more sensitive by in a very straightforward way. Becoming aware of the sensations in your head. Noticing any tendency to comment on those sensations or how you're doing. Or in the value of the exercise. See if you can be instead with the simplicity of the head's experience of itself. Whether it's pleasant or unpleasant doesn't really matter. Just let the sensations speak for themselves. And then move the attention down to the neck and shoulder area. And do the same thing there. The idea is not to judge your experience, but let it speak for itself, the sensations, letting your shoulder and neck area become more sensitized. And then continue down into your chest area, rib cage, front rib cage, and back rib cage. And in your own easy way, let the attention move around the torso area, letting that area become more sensitized, more awake. And then the same thing with your arms, upper arm, elbow, lower arm, hands. See if you can discover a greater range of sensations by tuning in to that part of your body. And then let the attention move to the area of your diaphragm and belly, abdominal area, your waist, your mid and lower back. And then the whole area around your pelvis, the pelvic area, pelvic cavity, the butt and the genitals. And then down into your hips and upper legs. The knees and the lower legs. There's no right or wrong thing to feel. Just let the sensations speak for themselves as if they have a right to be there, letting yourself become more sensitive by tuning in. And then down into your ankles and your feet. And then if there's any obvious ways you can do it, relax your whole body. And just feel for a few moments your whole body. If the whole body is an organ of perception. So in a few moments, I'm going to ask you to sit down. And because we're going to be changing your posture, the tendency for a lot of people is to use that time, during that time, to pop back into their thoughts and their ideas. And see if instead of doing that, you can now very quietly sit down, but stay connected to the whole body, to your body, what's happening on the inside of your body, the sensations, as if the body is a sensitive organ that you're going to stay in touch with as you quietly sit down. Okay. And close your eyes. Take an alert, relaxed posture. And then take some moments now to feel your body from the inside. If your whole body is the sensations are speaking to you or enlivening you or as if they have a right to show themselves. There may be pleasant sensations and unpleasant sensations. It doesn't matter for the purposes of meditation. Your job is to allow them all as if each of them have a right to be there. Your job is to simply be aware, becoming more sensitive to them. Sensitizing the awareness of the body. And then see if you can notice what the strongest sensation is in your body. It doesn't have to be very strong, but whatever happens to be the strongest. And let your attention rest in that part of your body. And simply, directly, become more sensitive to what that part of your body is really feeling. Not what you think is going on, but directly and immediately, as if there's a whole world which can open up for you if you simply tune in to that part of your body. Perhaps you can allow the mind, the thoughts, to become quiet in favor of becoming more sensitive, silent sensitivity to what's happening in the moment in your body. If you find it helpful as a way of keeping you on track with your body, you can very softly whisper in the back of your mind a label or naming that experience you're paying attention to. Naming the sensation of hardness as hard, hard. Pressure or tightness as tightness, tightness, pressure. Pressure. It's like using a very rudimentary thought to you help keep you present, as opposed to your thinking mind being free to do whatever it wants. If what is the strongest sensation in your body changes, then let your attention change to the new sensation. Sometimes it can feel like a dance of sensations. And then let your attention now move to your breathing, to the way in which your body experiences the breathing. You can name each breath if that helps you stay focused. In, out, or rising, falling. And in the same way that you got more sensitive to the hand as you tuned into it and paid attention to it, see if you can become more sensitive to what the body feels when you're breathing. The sensations of breathing within the body, the places in the body that feels the breathing. Each time you exhale, let go of any thoughts and concerns which have crept in that might be hijacking you. So then to repeat the instructions is that in your meditation practice, continue making the breathing the primary anchor for your mindfulness. Give yourself some devotion, loving devotion to the breathing. The breathing is perhaps one of your best friends you could possibly have. And to really be with it, breathing in and out, one after the other. But if some bodily experience in your body or hearing some sound becomes more pronounced, more compelling than your breathing, then you can let go of the breath and develop your meditative awareness on that physical experience. If that experience is no longer compelling or it's passed away, no longer there, then you can come back and begin again with your breathing. If you're with some sensation and it stays for a long time, it's compelling for a long time, it's completely fine to let a whole meditation session be a sensation of meditation on one sensation of your body. If this, what's most compelling in your body changes, then you can let your attention kind of gently flow and move from one to the other. As you do it, develop a greater sensitivity and awareness to your body. Let your body kind of show itself to you, reveal itself to you, what it has. The body stores and holds so much of who we are and what our past has been. And sooner or later, the body can help us process that material, that stuff, our life. And I would encourage you for this next week, for you as you go about in your daily life, begin paying attention to what your body's experience is of your life. If you're at work and you sit at a desk or computer, tune in to what your body's experience is like doing your work. Is your body just something you lug around and ignore, and does it feel abandoned by you or kind of oppressed by you as you sit there in bad posture? Or how does your awareness of the body, sensations of the body, change in different circumstances? How does your bodily experiences change with different emotions as they arise? Sometimes our emotions are in the stomach, sometimes in the chest, sometimes in the face. Start becoming aware of the life of the body, as if the body really counted, was important. And what you'll find as you do the mindfulness practice over time is that you can trust your body. And the body has a tremendous capacity to help us find balance and wisdom and healing in our lives if we trust it. And often what we do is we don't trust it we don't necessarily talk this way or think this way, but de facto we're kind of trusting our thinking mind, our mind that can figure things out and sort things out. And often our thinking mind is like a closed loop. We're just kind of spinning and spinning and spinning. And a way of stepping outside of the box of our fixed loop of thinking is to begin trusting our body more and being with the bodily experience of what's happening and see what you can learn about yourself and the world around you by being more in your body. Wonderful things like love and joy, I believe, can only be experienced fully if the body shares in those experiences, if the body is the vehicle for the expression of those feelings. If we're not paying attention to our body, not present for it to some degree, not living an embodied life, joy, love, peace, compassion are so much more difficult to access or let them flow through us and be part of who we are. So for this next week, I'd encourage you, as much as you can, get to know your body, even if you think you know it well. I don't think we can know our bodies well enough. And that investigation of our bodily experience, both in meditation and daily life, will be a very important and useful foundation for next week, when we talk about how to bring mindfulness into our emotional life, to our emotions. So that's the tasks. Is there anything that, yes? Sorry?
Do you want to add any more sitting time to the 15 minutes?
So you, last week I suggested you sit, if you're new to all this, that you meditate 15 minutes a day as a way of kind of getting this under your belt. So you kind of try to apply what you're learning here. And what I recommend is now you increase that by 5 minutes. So rather than 15 minutes, you sit 20 minutes each day. I think you'll get the most out of the instructions and teaching here during the course if you're applying it or trying to apply it at least the best you can at home or during your lunch hour at work.
You yes? mean that should be 20 minutes in one sitting or ten sittings with that?
Yeah, I would prefer you make it 20 minutes in one sitting. If your life is busy, so that's impossible, then I'd be very happy with two sessions of 10 minutes. But if you can, at least for the duration of this course, to follow the way I'm instructing you, I think you'll find more benefit from it. And then afterwards, you can decide to vary it in some way that works for you better. We can take maybe a minute or two before you have some questions. Is it clear enough today? Or comments? Commentary? If you dare? Yes?
I have a question. When you get more aware of life around you or your body, wouldn't it, well, I have a feeling that it would be very overwhelming because you're starting to notice things you didn't notice before.
Yes.
And it's too much.
It can be. Yes, sometimes it can be too much. So we have an overstimulated society. But sometimes the stress we have from being overstimulated is not from the stimulation itself, but rather that it's as if we have all these hooks or buttons inside of us. And the environmental experiences are hitting these hooks, these buttons, and triggering things within us. Resistance, fear, anger, aversion, all these things. And the reason why we sometimes get exhausted or stressed or overwhelmed by it is because of what it hits within us. So part of the function of mindfulness practice is then not to kind of shut yourself off from the world so you can feel good, but rather become aware of those buttons. Let the mindfulness include those so you can become free of those buttons. And then what happens in the world just go right through you, in a sense. You'll be very sensitive, very open, very present for things, but it doesn't stick anywhere. Does that make sense? Teflon mind. Teflon heart. I don't know if that's good PR, but yes.
I noticed that when I'm diving, you know, being a diver, when I dive and I feel the sensation that I can't get enough air,
yeah.
Then I tune into the air and the intake of the breath going in and out, and I'm quite comfortable. Now here, when I tune into the breath, I get that feeling like I cannot breathe. Before, when I'd rather go to the breath because I seem to escape it when I use a word, when I use a word in my mind and channel that, and I'm wondering why, you know, I maybe more needs to be revealed to myself and keep coming back to that. But the sensation of not being able to get enough air, you know, my body seems to be starved for air.
Yeah. That's very interesting, and it happens to a number of people. It's not uncommon. And if you're willing, I think maybe the best route for mindfulness practice is simply to go along with that and not to make it a problem, but continue to develop your mindfulness of what that sensation feels like. Study it so well, you could write a dissertation on what it feels like to not get enough air. What you'll probably find, if you really allow for it and really be present for it fully, it'll resolve itself in its own way. If you're trying to control it and fix it, you'll probably be kind of stuck in that loop forever. So just be very patient with it and just allow it to be there. More pragmatically, you might see if there's any place you're holding. And I've known some people, especially women, who report what you reported, and often they are holding their stomach. They're not really relaxing a diaphragm in their stomach. They've been taught growing up that women are supposed to hold their belly in or something. And sometimes by relaxing that, sometimes you can feel more, breath is more full and easier. Is that? Yes? Yes.
And that really struck me because I'm not sure, like, when do you honor your preferences and when do you not? Because, I mean, that's part of being human is to have preferences.
Sure.
And I think you can have preferences without being totally attached and driven by them. But then it almost seems like a contradiction of terms to not have preferences at all or to not be led by preferences.
Yeah.
And then to have healthy preferences. Like, how do you reconcile the two?
I think that you're not expected to have no preferences. I think that that'd be a problem if you had no preferences at all. But if you were led by them, means that you're kind of, you feel compelled by them. You're driven by them. What I want has to be the way it has to be, and get out of my way. You know, just it has to. You know, I don't want that, so it absolutely can't be. Then there's no freedom. But if you have a preference, and you can take it or leave it, then you can wisely see, oh, then you have much more choice about whether you pick that up or not. And then you might have the wisdom to see, well, that preference, if I do that right now, is not for my benefit. I mean, it happens to me, I have a lot of preferences. I have a lot of desires. They're like a dime a dozen. They're really easy to have. And sometimes I would prefer to have, coffee at 11 o'clock at night. You know, but I'm not compelled by that. It's just a thought that bubbles up in my mind or somewhere, and I have that preference. But I don't have to. I'm free of acting on it, and then I can evaluate: is it really useful for me to have coffee at 11 o'clock at night? And I find it's not. So I can easily let it go. It's okay. But if I can't let it go, I gotta have it. Then I'm not free. Sure.
In which case you have a greater affinity towards some person, type of person than another. But then, how can you still feel the same amount of love or compassion for all people if you have a general affinity towards a particular type of person?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know if we're expected to have exactly the same kind of love for everyone. Love is kind of multidimensional. But there is a kind of love which can be universal, which exists outside of our preferences. And so part of the value of learning not to be led around by our preferences is then we have a chance to open up to something which is more universal. So you sit down next to someone who you prefer actually not to sit next to this person. This person is just, you know, not a very pleasant... There are unpleasant people in the world. They're unpleasant because they haven't bathed for 3 weeks or, you know, they... Behavior is really unusual and unpleasant. I mean, there are such unpleasant things. And if you're always a slave to wanting pleasant and unpleasant and reacting always to what's unpleasant or holding on to what's pleasant, then you won't discover this wonderful thing that can happen kind of independent of pleasant or unpleasant. And I've been around people who are unpleasant, and I have some ability now not to live by my preferences there. And it can actually be quite wonderful. And a certain kind of love can flow to that person that wouldn't have been possible if I was, you know, always going with my preferences. It might be some different aspects or different qualities of that love because I don't feel an affinity to that person. But there is something more universal and wonderful. And it's often sometimes a real gift we give to people when they really feel that we're willing to meet people as, you know, kind of equally, fully, regardless of our preferences. I mean, you've been to kind of parties where, you know, people don't prefer you. You know, it's like, you know, it doesn't feel good. You know, it's nice when sit down with someone, someone's really there and willing to, you know, just be with you as you are.
Is that, in your example, that person doesn't bathe for 3 weeks or something, like, then how do you know when you want to be there in spite of their hygiene and when you want to respect your preference of being with someone who smells better?
Well, some of it has to do with some idea you have of the consequence of what's going to happen. if you feel the consequence, for, there's a whole range of things that factors that come into a decision like that. But consequence is one of them, the cause and effect relationship. So, for example, you might say, you might recognize in this person, I think it would be really helpful for this person if I gave this person a little bit of time and a smile. And people, no, most people don't give this person a time of day. It would help this person a lot to have human contact with someone. And that's of greater value than my preferences, you know, my own life and what I want and don't want. Another time you might decide that if I stay with this person anymore, I'm going to be so reactive that I'm going to start acting out in all kinds of funny ways and get a headache. This is not useful. So you can start trying to use your best ability to evaluate the situation, decide what is most useful to do. But it's easiest to decide what to do if you develop the capacity to not be led around by your preferences. Good luck. Okay, so thank you all very much, and I wish you a wonderful week. And may you discover the great love that's possible when you're not led around by your preferences.